Greetings all, what is the good word? Thank you for stopping the scroll and spending some of your valuable time with us. This is the Coptimizer podcast, and I'm your host, Patrick Flannelly, retired chief of police and all-around wannabe renaissance man. Here we look to spend some time with leaders and pioneers that have a passion for public safety and those who look to build strong and resilient individuals and organizational cultures, both of which result in stronger communities. We look across industries with a focus on peak performance. Our biggest questions, what can I do to squeeze every little drop of life out of each day? How do I get a little bit better today than I was yesterday? And how can I tap into the energy that makes it all possible? While our focus is on first responders and those in public service, the lessons shared here on the Coptimizer podcast are universal. Our goal is to hire healthy, retire healthy, and maximize impact in our personal and professional lives in that time in between. To drive value and squeeze every drop out of our performance so we can be awesome for our families, our departments, and our communities. Better performing officers make for better performing organizations. This is not a complicated truth. It is the simple truth. From the top cop to the street cop and all those working in support of high-performing organizations, this show is for you. It's time to Coptimize. Good afternoon and welcome back to the Coptimizer podcast. This afternoon's guest is Chief Kenny Cavanaugh from the Jeffersonville, Indiana Police Department. Chief Cavanaugh, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me here, Pat. Greatly appreciate you.
Let's dive right in. Tell us a little bit about yourself, how you got into policing, and maybe a little bit about your organization.
Absolutely. Been in policing now here with Jeffersonville Police Department, here down south, southern Indiana, for 28 years. Started with the year with Clark County Sheriff's Office as a correctional officer. That was the pilot show there of 60 days in. No, it was not like 60 days in then, but started my career there at 28 years of age. So I get to share that fun fact of starting my law enforcement career.
That's a tough job. I'm going to interrupt you, but you know, we see what's going on in Florida right now. I've always had a high level of concern for our corrections officers because, man, you want to talk about a difficult environment to work in. We're definitely going to have some guests on the show that work in corrections, and I've got a few things in mind down the road.
Absolutely, and you know, continuing on, had my career here, been a great career. Born and raised in Jeffersonville, Indiana. Started my career here with the department in 1994. And I've had the fortunate enough experience to work up from the patrol level all the way to the level of March 16th of 2015 of being appointed chief of police by Mayor Mike Moore here in Jeffersonville, Indiana. So, you know, serving the citizens of the community that I was born and raised in, I greatly take pride and, you know, very appreciative to be here and spend my life in the city, but also to have my life dedicated to public safety. So for me, becoming a police officer, my father was a Jeffersonville firefighter. And in December of 1965, my father was sworn in as a Jeffersonville firefighter, being the first African-American firefighter employed by the city of Jeffersonville at that time. And the history for us at Jeffersonville was approximately 6 months prior, the first African-American police officer, Mr. William Locke, was sworn in. And you recognize the time period of 1965, and you recognize where the country was. Those were significant challenges for our community, but those were accomplishments that did happen to occur. So,
yeah, that's amazing.
Absolutely. As you know, why am I in public safety and in law enforcement? My father was a firefighter, a military veteran, and my grandfather served as a federal police officer, the Federal Protective Services. So here in Jeffersonville, Indiana, as some people may not recognize and know, this is where the United States Census Bureau headquarters is. This is where the census takes place. And my grandfather was a Federal Protective Services police officer there. So I'm a third generation in public safety, and my grandfather retired from the Federal Protective Services. So being around and serving and giving to your community, that's something my family has a history of and I take on. And I'm proud to say that my son is the fourth generation, and he is a military veteran, college graduate. He's been here with the Jeffersonville Police Department for 3 years, serving here underneath dad's command as well. So that family service.
So that's awesome. And, you know, we've had some conversations about this on some of our previous episodes. And so I think it's important to maybe spend a couple minutes talking about this. Policing and public safety, generally police and fire, they have historically been family traditional type jobs, you know, where, you know, maybe back in the day, there was a little bit of nepotism involved, but, you know, in modern policing, I think institutionally, we've always kind of relied on our best people out there promoting the career and the opportunities that it can provide to people that enter into public safety, whether it's being a firefighter, which, you know, that has to lead to some very interesting conversations. One of my uncles was a firefighter as well in Scranton, Pennsylvania. And so, you know, when I would make firefighter jokes with my dad or others, you know, we always do them in good humor because it is a fun rivalry. But yeah, that, I mean, one of the concerns that we've had recently in the last 5 to 6 years is that we're not seeing police professionals actively promoting the profession to their loved ones, their children, their nieces, their nephews, people that are close to them. But you're the exception to that rule. Like, you know, your son is a veteran, and now he's also in the profession. So how do those conversations go?
You know, Pat, being around public safety, my family, that's something that obviously grown up on us serving our community, serving our country. And that's something that obviously talk about. And I'm proud that my son is taking those steps. He obviously, as a parent, you feel that worry and that concern of, you know, what exactly is your child going to do. And I look at policing through that lens of, now that is my son that is now participating and involved in this profession, that I know that every day the inherent risk and the dangers that he faces, those challenges. So I feel that, and I see that as a human being, and we talk about humanizing the badge. So humanizing that badge, I see that as a father. I see that as a police officer, and I see that as a policing executive. And that's, you know, that's where I think there's three parallels there: father, police officer, and policing executive. You know, and that's, you know, what's evolved and how you see that. And that's a way to look at that. But I'm proud, man. I feel that, you know, carried on even where we are now with the challenges, that I have a son that is wanting to be in a profession. And I look at men and women that are coming in, and I do know this, I do see this, interviews, people who do make it and do not. I really believe that we're seeing a deeper dive passion, maybe with a small number. And you and I have had this conversation, and one of the things we're going to touch upon, communicating with me and other leaders, but I'll share this with you to put this out and unscripted. I was at a Merit Commission meeting last night, and this came up with recruiting, where we're spending with advertising, and that statute for the Merit Commission calls for it to be in public print media, newspaper. And we're looking at dollars spent, and we're not hitting the digital market, media market. We're not there. And I referenced Chief Linnelli from Lafayette, our conversation. I referenced you when we were talking in January, and the numbers, you said that, you know, 150 officers, you're 30 down. I think you shared with me 20 applications, and you come up with one candidate. And I was able to, you know, that's having that conversation, that dialogue, you know, and being there is a great opportunity, example for me. And I used you last night in your police merit, my Jeffersonville Police Merit Commission meeting. I was able to reference you. So I'll give you your credits here. And, you know, but that's what This is with communicating with other leaders and having that information for me to find out what's going on there in another part of the state of Indiana and versus here, Southern Indiana, those types of trends and that information. I think you can expand upon this, how us, our communication, it's given an indication of what I need to know here when upon making decisions.
Yeah. That's when you're down, you know, 10 officers, 20, 30, the bigger agencies that are getting to into the 50, the 100, 500 officers per, it's that, you know, it's a common theme that we've had in these discussions. It puts a lot of pressure on the existing workforce and it puts pressure on the organization. But yeah, you're right. You know, the number of applications are way down. And we always took the approach that we're never going to lower our standards. We're not going to change what we do because we know that character, that integrity, bringing the right people into the profession is the only way to succeed in the future. And you can't cut corners, but you know, you do concern, you know, that does concern me about how that might impact the future. You've taken on this example of be the change that you want to see in the world and this pressure that we've had on law enforcement, because it is tough for young officers and for agencies and you know, particularly for you know, trying to recruit and not just recruit anyone, but recruit quality applicants that are reflective of your community, you know, a good diverse group of candidates. So when you're policing, your police department looks like your community. And not only are you walking the walk, but you're talking the talk. And I commend you for that. And that's a big accomplishment.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate the accolades. And you touched on something there of wanting to reflect within our policing agency that's across the country on what that community is. And that is a challenge right now. That is really a deep challenge right now. But I'm going to say with the interviews of the last 2 years, I'm hearing more people talk about their passion to serve more than I did so. And I think there's some, you and I both know when you're interviewing, you're listening for hitting that point, those P's and Q's. You pick up the sincerity from one that comes in and present themselves at this time and just hearing them, allow them to speak within the questions that are being presented. And you're looking for those high points. You're catching that. And I think that's the value and the character of the person that's sitting before you.
All right. So let's change gears a little bit. So you spent a significant part of your career working not just as a detective, but working as a narcotics undercover officer. And that is it's a career within a career. It's a challenge within a challenge. What do you think are some of the big lessons that you take away from working in that kind of stressful environment? And what was it like?
You know, looking at it, and I had some officers that were some senior tenure here within the department, and coming as a patrol officer and understanding, I wanted to know what made policing go around, what was going around, and quickly I come to recognize within 6 months, and it's pretty somewhere between in the time in the 90s, I could detect and determine somewhere between 6 to 8 out of 10 calls, your product number being 10, 6 to 8 calls had some type of narcotic tire, narcotic nexus in the derivative. So it did not take me long to recognize and realize what was driving us, even here in Southern Indiana, Jefferson, Indiana, right beside, separated by the Ohio River, Louisville, Kentucky. It's I-65 south and northbound, but you also have I-64, I-71 between Cincinnati by 94 miles, Indianapolis by 103. And then I've got to my west, I've got St. Louis, Missouri. And then further north of Indianapolis, I've got Chicago. So you kind of get that nexus of where we are here in Southern Indiana and Louisville, Kentucky. I was seeing some of the significant cases. I was seeing how trafficking and how I identified trafficking, and we would see street level narcotics. Things were evolving, but the rudiment of getting back to that big picture I just mentioned, your everyday calls for service, being a patrol beat officer in your community. And I just gave you that big picture demographic, but how it related for just everyday calls of service, and quickly started to realize that was in a time frame there. I came in the early 90s where we went from the 80s and we had crack cocaine. We went through that 90s. And I know this here, because I looked at something, I recall the stats and numbers, your area there in Lafayette, around, you know, methamphetamine was coming into place. You know, it was anhydrous, but, ephedrine, people.
The old school meth labs, yeah.
Yeah, there you go. So we were going through all the demographics of that, and it didn't take me long to realize that, you know, wanting to have an engagement, now I wanted to be a proactive police officer. Putting my education to find out and understanding exactly what probable cause and report writing. I was also that wanted to learn, and I wanted to be around investigators. Also wanted to know if I was properly and appropriately, if I was producing a good case report. So I didn't have an issue and problem speaking with anything in the prosecutor's office and the things of that nature. So it took me there, getting a basic platform. For 3.5 years, I wound up going into narcotics, and that was my drive. And during that time, also, I slipped in. I entered the SWAT team after about 18 months of being a police officer. So I was already there at that level, and you know everything what I mentioned, the tactical side of it, and leaving from patrol. But you and I both know, as investigators, it was a whole year training process of learning how to write from the investigative standpoint, how to be able to produce warrants, and understanding at the time it was back in pin registers, things of that nature.
Yeah.
It was all reworking and the components and platforms of informant managing. So I started retraining all again, but I had enough drive as a young police officer to put that all together. And I come to where I am at the day at this time here. Part of me being back in the chief's office and the major here at the time with both investigators, we expanded our narcotics investigative unit to where we have 4 investigators. And we have some part-time people that are attached with it. We created and set up some other programming, reorganizing and realigning the department. And our mission of proactivity of what we demonstrate, and we also want to follow the data. So you start talking intelligence-led policing, looking at versus randomization, how we are policing, but what manner, what scope, and that, things of that nature, because it all tied in that time for me then. And I got to be honest with you, it's predicated where the police department is now, that experience, but understanding I had to separate. When I say separate, I had to understand where we are now. I think that's important for police administrators. You're going to know this, of what we experienced 15, 20 years ago. And you know, that time, 28 years experience, or 24 years ago, recognize and take that experience, but understand the challenges that we face now. How do we theoretically apply that to policing concepts now to properly and appropriately police in this fashion of the time where we are now society?
Yeah. It's changing a lot. And those, like you were alluding to there, the 80s were the cocaine and the crack cocaine boom, which extended into the 90s. And then the early at least in the Midwest, we had this problem with meth labs that were springing up, where people were snatching pseudoephedrine off the shelves. They were stealing tanks from farms with anhydrous ammonia, and they were building these labs, which were very volatile, very dangerous. We went through that phase. And then we started to really see, you know, in the early 2000s, that transition from the homemade meth to the ICE that started, you know, Mexican ICE that started coming up from Mexico across the border. And then that changed, you know, eventually transitioned to heroin. And so everything cycles around. But right. Also, when you're in policing, you quickly realize that it's not 20% of your population that's driving your work. It's really closer to 2 or 3%. And when you know, having that background, and this is something that, you know, it's patrol officer 101. You start to recognize very quickly that there, for just about any call for service, there are central themes that are at play. There are things that are driving the calls for service. And when you look at some of the more dangerous types of calls, like domestic violence calls, suicidal subjects, the mental illness calls. A lot of those things have that narcotic nexus. So if you can, in theory, right? I think we all believe that if we can impact the flow of narcotics into our communities, if we can slow it down, if we can, somehow identify, through various different investigative methods, the people that are engaged in that process, then we can impact other crimes like thefts, like simple theft, shoplifting, burglary, robbery. It all comes back to that nexus of cash for dope.
And
so you're hitting that, those rudiments. So everything that you just named off and you just identified, the fundamental rudiments to those crimes happening and occurring, you and I both know the driving force there, the indicator that makes that happen is that desire and will of those persons and individuals that are wanting to acquire narcotics, illegal narcotics.
So you worked in that capacity for a long time, and I think they've got a, maybe not necessarily an accurate depiction of what that job entails, because, that's one of the things we see in popular media and movies, and, they make dramatic motion pictures about this stuff. We all grew up watching Miami Vice. Well, maybe not all of us. That was one of my shows, but
A few of us did. I never went out. I never had that case that I was in a suit. I only had a suit on when I went to court, and I'm trying to figure this out. What happened through my 90s? I was a pretty good looking guy, there in pretty good shape. I didn't wear a suit to work. I didn't have a leisure suit on. I don't know what happened that time. I only had a suit on when I went to court.
And so you were driving a Ferrari on your way to your pies, right?
Yeah, it's supercharged Pontiac Grand Prix. It's with rims. So it was a clear back then, it was a G ride. It's what I had.
Well, we're laughing about it, but there's also, it's a very dangerous, very dangerous job, and it can create a lot of stress on the people that we ask to do it. You're oftentimes living a little bit of a double life. You've got your work self, and it's different really for a local police officer really than it might be for some of our federal partners. And we do a lot of work with our federal partners because nobody knows the streets better than the people that live and work in them. But the problem is that when you live and work in these areas, even the bad guys know who you are, and the dopers, they know who you are. So to then take on this additional role where you're going to take on an alternate personality to persona, I should say, not personality, but to do the reversals, to do the undercover buys. You're operating on doper time when you're doing that job, and that doper time is its own time, and that can create a lot of stress on an individual and then also an individual's family. So, how did you manage the stressors and that kind of like the double life while you were doing that role?
It was tough. Being young married, young little guy at that time, in the schedule, my agency, investigator, still as a narcotics investigator, I had to manage that investigator on call day. So for just criminal cases, that from the criminal CID standpoint, I had a defined day. Back then it was the lower half of the investigators, and you started out in the division. So I got the luckily, when I came in, welcome to detective division, training platform, within 30 days there, 3 weeks of training. But your CID night, Friday nights, was my on-call night of after all week of long hours and warrants are there. I was off day or Saturday, Sunday. Friday nights was my on-call night. So any case that, past the time of 6 p.m. until 6 a.m. the next morning, that was an investigator. Then the Saturday, Sunday rotated. So then I had the would catch the Friday nights, and then I think it was every 8 or 9 weeks I had to catch the Saturday and the Saturday Sunday flip flop. So balancing that, and even with the workload, it was stressful. but having a life partner, my wife there, 25 years and understanding what it was I was doing and when I needed to do that. And back then, you're going to laugh and chuckle. We had cell phones, but we had the pagers. So, the rule of coming into the house, the pager went on, the alert sound, and it stayed up on the counter, what have you there. My wife would come, hey, your pager's going off, and there it is. If it's SWAT or investigator call out or investigator group call out. I remember coming in from a family trip and being in for a family trip and was not in the house. I want to say 10 minutes. I still remember we had an officer involved shooting, and it was obviously a knockout for everyone. I was in a commercial industrial area. An officer came upon an incident of a burglary, and situation happened occurred, and that was immediately traveling in. We'd been to an amusement park there in Ohio, and then the next 12 hours after Dad had been out, we had a great time with family and friends. I'm out investigating Officer Paul's shooting with the team of CID detectives, and everyone were running leads down. And you recognize, you understand, that's your dedication, that's your commitment. My wife did understand that. I think the next day was supposed to be a family dinner, and things are obviously I did not make that coming back in. So we still had the next day of things cleaning up, but that stands out in my mind there. Those times there, and how did you manage to make time? But you did. And I think that's the understanding of going into that profession, what the profession is, and understanding that there's a work-life balance commitment. And I would probably say, now we talk about officer wellness, and we give more consideration now than I want to say that, there wasn't much officer wellness. I want to say the consideration was, it was, you're assigned here in the position when the pagers, the beepers were going off and toning, that response of no matter where you were at or located, I remember they had the plan in the range, and then we were told that the range of the pagers we had, they were nationwide, nationwide paging system. And I'm like, well, if I'm out of the area, why do you need to? Well, you need to be up on and you need to know what's going on. So, okay, I'm out of the area traveling, but you still carry your that way. And someone wanted to page or beep you, getting you to call back or what have you, that was there. So looking at that time, considering just, you look back now where we are now, we really want to work in the profession. We talk about officer wellness. That balance, and to make sure that we're allowing people the opportunity to disengage. And that's something we look at now with our investigators and our load. I mean, I know it's rough and stuff for them and all investigators level around the country, that load that's coming in, and how do you balance them? Officers who are working, crimes against persons, crimes against children, looking at that aspect I've seen here internally, working that and making sure that we're rotating people out. And we also, after we found that we were being proactive, offering services to the officers that are assigned, those investigators, those types of foul cases, to be able to have an outlet resource to make sure that they are not holding and keeping all of that in. I had one officer tell me here, and an investigator, and now police administrators, I got to the point of working these cases and looking at it, not trusting anyone. And so you have to recognize as an administrator, no one around my kids or children, these cases, this is what this is doing to me, starting to create that personal paranoia. So we have to recognize now when we're hearing those things, those are indicators on what we need to do and how we need to be. We respond, but we really want to be the word is proactive with our people and our personnel with wellness and identifying that, something to touch on where we are today. And it helps us with the profession of gaining and getting these numbers.
Well, you jumped ahead on me, because that's exactly where we were going with this conversation. You've had a varied career. You've worked in patrol. You've worked in SWAT. You've been involved in investigations. And you just started to touch on that. Well, it's the way that we do things in the past isn't necessarily the way that we want to do things in the future. What we want to try to do is take all the best lessons learned and teach those moving forward. And also try to make sure that people understand where we've come from, so understanding your history is important as well. So, it's a, It's a delicate balancing act, but it's also critically important. And, you know, because cops hate two things, right? That's the old joke. It's not just cops. It's everybody. We hate change, but we hate the way things are also. So there, you know, if you're going to complain about something, then, you know, you always sometimes have to just take a moment to reflect. But yeah, lot to cover there. And one of the things that you have stressors on narcotics officers, I think people watching TV might see some of that, and maybe some of popular culture, you know, captures the other aspect of it. But the crimes against children, those things, wow, that is a brutal, brutal job, and it is so difficult. And for police in America, we ask our officers and our investigators to do a lot, you know, to crawl into the deepest, darkest places, that humankind has to offer. And then we just have this expectation sometimes that it's just not going to impact them or it's not going to affect them.
Right.
And that's just not true. I don't care how experienced you are. I think, you know, anyone that's done the job, I don't care how small your community is or how big it is, you know, these problems are just a matter of scale, but they are everywhere and they can impact people. So as a chief, understanding that now, and maybe also understanding that we didn't necessarily do a good job in the 80s and 90s and even early 2000s about preparing people for these stressors and providing the right types of resources to help mitigate maybe some of the long-term traumatic effects that can have and how that impacts overall health. I also appreciate your proactive position that you're taking with your department and some of the training that you've talked about, some of the things that you're doing. You've been very, I think, open with your engagement with the Axon Coaching Group to bring in that group to provide additional levels of resources. You have EAP resources. What am I missing? What are some of the other things that you're doing to help prepare your officers, not just your new officers, but also your experienced workforce members?
Relationship. I have a chaplain, Conrad Moore, a great gentleman. He's been here 30 years plus, and I had the ability there when he retired from his pastoral duties with his church. I think it was approximately 2018, brought him in to a part-time capacity since he retired, and he had been here. But let me tell you, he has his office here set up, and he has been here 30 years, longer than I've been here. And I became February of this year, became the senior member, but he is actually the senior member of this department. So he is here. He has a background. His focus and studies there of counseling, and his relationship, as chaplain, but also being someone that everyone's comfortable, familiar with, to come in and speak with him. He comes out and jumps in the car. He is available. And from the standpoint of not having, a policing administrator call you, but someone that has been around you, that's familiar with you, knows your family, to get a text message or you get a call from him. Well, I've had officers tell me this, and even me, my experience, you know, he gives you a call and me here in this parking lot and shows up and hey, what's going on? And he asks you that patented question. Hey, I want to check on you and see how you're doing. Just to be able to have someone that you're comfortable and you're familiar with, that you know that you can have that conversation, you can talk, or, you know, he's not there to document anything. But he also has a responsibility of identifying if there's indicators of things of nature that he needs to start that process for some direct services or other things additional to have some more focused sessions. He is there at communication fees. So we put that layer in, thanks to my city council, my mayor, that has been supportive of that. And then we also here in Southern Indiana, it's multiple counties. It's operating actually south of Indianapolis down in crisis management team through Life Springs Health System. He also receives calls from Southern Indiana throughout the state up to the Seymour, Denny's, Columbus, area, first responders involved in incidents. We have a network in multiple counties around. I consider this almost a District 9 area that's fielding phone calls. They have crisis management teams and people and personnel that are trained to go out and speak with. It's police, fire, EMS, all types of first responders that are involved in these engagements. I think that's something that's going on in my department, but there's numerous other departments that are participating. Seymour PD, there's other PDs that are around, fire EMS agencies. I think everyone's understanding this for the first responder network well, and we're all communicating. We're doing this as a conglomerate, and there's individuals from different agencies that are involved. Some agencies involved do not have, they have some members of other community teams there, but we have a good demographics of team, and I think they have trained personnel up to about 30 that are involved with this crisis management team. It's good perspective.
Yeah.
You get to leverage all that experience, not maybe just within your own agency. And also, because again, another common theme, you know, one of the things that we're hoping to educate folks on through the process of the show, not every police department is the same. You know, our level of resources are different. You can have police departments with 3 to 5 officers all the way up to 3,500, all the way up to your 35,000 members. But what we, you know, what you do in Jeffersonville can impact what we do in Lafayette, which can impact what happens in California and Florida and other places. So that sounds like, again, one of those programs where we get to leverage our experiences from the past, build on our neighboring communities and the experience that they bring to bring a program to your agency and your communities, and also help out others. So when we were chatting before we started recording, you made a comment that I really like the question. You know, I should say it was a question that you asked, and the question is, you know, when we look at policing and when we look at all the different issues that we're trying to manage, you said, where is the change in policing going to come from? So maybe expound a little bit upon that, and the reason why you ask yourself that question, and then what you bring to your agency through that answer.
Absolutely. Looking at it coming in from the gateway, and I say the gateway, when you're hiring, you're bringing an officer in, and we all are tasked with those assignments of getting people in, getting trained, and getting out on the street. You know, I have to draw from my policing experience of being that shift commander, being a patrol commander, and understanding that people coming in and training. And I think that I really saw, and I would make notes and look at, you know, what are our issues, what are our problems. So, and I always said, if I had the opportunity, I wanted to affect the change through the department. And I would do, I was big on looking at policing websites, looking at what data and information things were coming out. And I knew the focus was on, and I could see enough of what I was able to research and pick up on your training platform. So when you talk about how we're going to make that change, we know we're in a rush, we need to get the people out, but how are we training the men and women that are coming into this department? Are we setting them up in a position or in a capacity for success? And that right there, you know, I want to get people out, but if we don't get them out in the right context, the right manner, we do not fulfill our obligations of ensuring that we have competent, trained people that are out here, deployed out here for public safety. That's an issue. That's a problem in itself.
And it puts, yeah, that's fantastic. And it's a great point, because it puts pressure on your existing workforce, knowing that, hey, we've got some openings that we need to fill. So someone has to step in and fill those gaps until then, which generally means working overtime, working extra shifts. But, you know, the temptation can be there, right, to get that minimally viable product, that minimally trained officer, and then put them out and then hope to be able to monitor and supervise them in a way that you can lead them to success. But we also know that, you know, creates its own struggles and its own challenges, because, you know, we, you know, we've seen a lot of examples around the country in the last 5 years of what can happen to an officer who's not properly trained and not properly prepared for what their responsibilities are. You know that you're responsible for not only your decisions, but oftentimes you can be responsible for what you may not do based on what somebody else has done. And that's, you know, it's easy to say, man, I would have done this or I should have done that. If I were in that same officer's shoes, I would do it differently. But it's another thing to be in that position and feel that pressure and to be unsure of yourself. And, you know, a lack of competence equals a lack of confidence, and a lack of confidence translates into poor performance, bad decisions.
And indecisive decisions. So, again, are we setting our people up for success? You know, we're having an exodus and we have people that are retiring and coming out of the profession, and we're having problems intaking. But I think that we have to leverage ourselves as a law enforcement community as a whole to commit ourselves to, as we're having the new people come into the profession, look at your training platform, look at how we are producing these police officers out for duty. You know, are we setting them up to be successful? Are we setting them up for sustainable outcomes that we're going to be able to accomplish and we're going to be able to achieve together with our community? And are those outcomes sustainable? And I think that's where we get into this in a country that everyone in a nation and people feel that, no, there's not going to be an acceptance. This is not sustainable. And we're not going to believe we're not going to have this in our community. And then we get to where we have a disagreement. And I think that from our standpoint, looking at it, predicating this all the way from the beginning, reaching outcomes that are sustainable, and how do we get there to achieve this with our people and our personnel?
Yeah. And so again, being the positive person that you are and having the, I take you as a glass half full person. You know, you made a comment also that sure, we've got challenges, right? But challenges always present opportunities if you're willing to look for them. If you don't bury your head, or if you can take a moment to, you know, to kind of look out into the future and look upon the horizon of what's coming to the profession, if we take those time, that time, then maybe we can see what the opportunities are. And your comment was, we've got a great opportunity now that we have young officers coming in to create a revision and a reshaping of what the vision of the future is going to look like for policing, not trying to take the old square peg model and pound it into a round hole, but actually mold the future of what, you know, what we expect from our officers, and then in work with our communities to do the same thing.
Absolutely. So you something that you and I didn't see, and you both know that there was not a push to apply that communication piece. You know, I remember coming as a young police officer, that 15-minute time, hammering those calls out, you know, do not be there too long. I know you've heard that. You remember those days, you know, at the commander's, my first shift commander was at a serving since been in 1969. I was born in 1972. And I recall looking at that going, wow, man, this guy's been around here for a while. But I remember that I was told that one thing, you don't want to get on his bad side. Do not be on calls. Do not milk any calls. Do not be there too long. 15 minutes wrapped up. And you and I both know 15 minutes is you cannot get, you know, then we got a lot wrapped up. But right now where we are, we talk about that communication piece. We need our officers to be able to have a dialogue, build rapport, explain what's happening, what's going on, even when, you know, people of the public do not agree or understand. I think it's that communication piece. We have the opportunity to leverage that situation by taking some additional time. Let's try to talk. Let's try to explain what's happening, what's going on here. Let's lay out what's occurred, what action we're taking, and then provide them with information where they've got any concerns to be able to follow up. But let's just put it right out front here. And, you know, while we have the body cams and we're able to do this, let's take advantage and let's do this. And, you know, does it seem reasonable? Does it seem prudent? Because I'm going to come back and look at the time, what we're doing, how we're handling the situation, how we're trying to theoretically apply resolve. Let's take some time. Let's put these practices into place. And I think that that scope of training and where we are now, we do not, we do not hammer out the 15 minutes. Let's get these calls wrapped up here in Jeffersonville. Obviously, we have to be efficient, but to be efficient and to work efficiently, we have to be effective. And, you know, we have to do that within reason. And
yeah, that's it. Well, you just said it right. That, you know, it's easy to be busy. It's not necessarily the same as being effective, though. You know, sometimes, you know, and that's, you know, a lot of conversations internally amongst commanders, right? It's, sure. You know, we can, data is incredibly important, and I'm a big data person. You know, what we've done in the past helps us make, good resource decisions about what we're going to do in the future. But, you know, data is just one, you know, it's one decision point. It's not the whole decision point. So we want to make sure that what we're doing is driving value. And so for the officer that makes 20 or 30 traffic stops, here, I'll use this example. You have an officer that, you know, maybe they're traffic oriented, but they like to make a lot of traffic stops and maybe, you know, write a lot of citations or warnings. And you look at it, and if you're just a data person, you could say, man, this officer is really busy. They're making 20 traffic stops a day or 30 traffic stops a day, and they're writing X number of tickets. But if we're not asking the question of, well, where are they writing these tickets? Is it in the outlying road that, you know, where the speed limit goes from 55 down to 35 and then back up to 55? And there's very few people around. There are no traffic accidents there. Very few pedestrians. You know, what are we accomplishing with that? Now, if the same officer is in the heart of the city, working the area where you've got your busiest intersection and where you have a lot of crashes, a lot of people that are disregarding traffic signals, running red lights, because those tend to be some of the higher complaint types of calls that come into police departments. Well, Now we've got a different outcome that we're looking at. We're driving some value here because, you know, one of the few things that we know in policing is that we can have an impact on. The more citations you write, the fewer crashes that you have, if you're doing it in the right way. So, that's, you know, cool. There is, you know, that's an outcomes-based approach to what you're doing, but it's also, you know, those are two different things. And if, you know, if you're the, and so, sometimes as a young officer, and I'll go off on a little tangent here, because people always think that, oh man, you know, police officers, they want to write people tickets. They love to do it. And I'm not going to say that there's not a few out there that, you know, really enjoy that process, but it's been my experience. And that sometimes it's very difficult to get a police officer to actually write a ticket, because they know, hey, I've gotten a ticket. I know how it impacted me. I don't necessarily want to write somebody else a ticket because I don't want to impact them negatively. And, you know, you actually have to kind of train it into an officer. Well, you know, we also know the data suggests that if all you do is write warnings, you're not going to have any impact on your traffic safety. So for the citizens that are listening to this conversation, it was always a great conversation with our citizens academies. But, you know, that's just one example of, you know, are you being busy? Are you being effective? You know, what's the outcome you're searching for?
Absolutely. And I think you touched upon that. We participate in some of the state grant programming. So as we have hot spots and we have trouble locations that are called in, or we make an identification, maybe with the volume with some crashes, we may have those people who are deployed on those details. We may strategize and focus them to target the areas where we've got identifiable data. And look at that time frame. I think some of the technology that we've leveraged that with the target signs, the radar trailers, that also the data collection, And this is actually before deploying an officer out there, a resource out in the field. You know, we will actually, in some cases, many cases, we'll actually put that signboard out there, have the messaging, and then you can collect that data after 72 hours or even go up to five days beyond, and then bring that back. And you can actually review that data that's coming in and look at the time frames. We've also had those where they're drag racing down the road, they're burning speed, and we find the average speed is only, we've had it 5 to 7 miles per hour. It's not happening during. I welcome that. We contacted those there. Here's the data. It may appear, but this is what we're capturing. And then we went out, we'll verify that to see, and it does come consistent just to check that data in the area. And I think that's, again, communicating back to those that have that concern. And I think you and I recognize that, geez, sometimes I call it hot rodding. We have those that may want to hot rod some of that lightning bolt that information to us, and that's not the case. Here's what the case of the day is, and we've also backed that up with an actual person deployed in the field to witness that as well. So that is, again, technology on our side, our friends. Some people don't want to embrace it, but I think we find the ways and leverage the technology to embrace that to be able to deliver our message.
I well said. That, you know, because, you know, the number one complaint that comes into police departments is traffic related, and it's speed related. If people are driving so fast down my streets, if the police don't get out here and do something about this, someone's going to die, and it's on your hands. It'll be your fault. And so, you know, I say that with a chuckle, because I know that people are concerned about those types of issues. And just like you said, when you can provide a data driven solution to that using your traffic control devices, your engineering control devices, you know, you get into the neighborhoods and the areas, particularly around schools and other areas where parents are highly concerned. And yeah, so that's been exactly our experience. The average speeds are generally 5 to 7 miles an hour over the speed limit. And then you have a few outliers under, a few outliers over, but you know, when you're looking at mean, median and mode numbers, generally speaking, you know, 90% of your traffic is within that 5 miles an hour of the speed limit. So being able to show neighbors that, and then the other thing is typically when it's inside neighborhoods, it's people that live in those neighborhoods. So the people that are complaining about what's happening, they're also sometimes just as guilty as maybe someone that, you know, might be traveling through their neighborhood. But all great examples of, you know, I know we got off on a little tangent there, but
that's good. And that's one there you touch upon, but we utilize, and I'm not a personal social media account person, but what we do is I ask them, especially when you get that time frame, it starts about 3:30, 4 o'clock to 7. You and I both know that's people coming in, coming out. We've got to get in, we've got to change, we've got to get to Little League practice or get to our next appointment. And getting that message out on the residential neighborhood Facebook page of, hey, everyone, let's watch our speed, and here's a time frame. Because you and I both know going into that residential area and you stop 6 vehicles during that time frame, high probability, and I've seen the probability all 6 vehicles are residents of that nature. And just, I know I'm frequently coming through here, but that one car equals 2 cars, 3 cars, 4 cars, and car number 5 and 6 are residents of that neighborhood that are involved or engaged, unintentional. I think you have to look at it's unintentional of driving habits and people becoming complacent practices, and that happens in the GERF.
And we can go back to the point of being busy versus being effective. If you're capturing that data and you can look at a 72-hour or a 5-day window, what you're also finding is the times of day when you're getting the peak traffic and when you're getting your peak speeders. So now you can go back into your neighborhoods. You can use social media groups like Nextdoor and others and let people know, hey, this is what we're doing. This is why we're doing it. Help be our eyes and ears. And we're letting you know why we're in your neighborhood, what our approach is, what the complaints have been. And then when we make traffic stops, people know, and we can explain to them we're in this area because we've had a high level of complaints about speeders. But we also know that in particular, on your street between the hours of 3 p.m. and 4 p.m., our data is suggesting this is when we're getting the most people that are, you know, in that 7 mile an hour to 15 mile an hour window over the speed limit. And so that it's more palatable for people. We're not setting someone out there for 8 hours just to sit there and watch cars go by. We Right. can deploy our resources in a more effective manner and get a, you know, that's a win. So there's a really good example of how we take technology, we apply it to our strategy and our tactics, and we go out and get the job done. All right, we're bumping up on that. I told you this would go really fast. So we could continue talking for a while, but there's a couple things that I really, I kind of wanted to touch base on before we go, but I appreciate your enthusiasm for developing the future of policing, and then by taking that coaching approach for your officers. And I'm not just talking about like a program like Axon Coaching. I'm talking about what you do internally with your staff and your people, and coaching people from day one about building a better future for your agency. So I know I've probably forgot to ask you at least one good question. So what's one thing that I haven't asked you today that you're like, all right, I'm waiting for this question to come from Pat. Is he going to give it to me?
I don't know. I think you've covered. I think we've hit, and for me, people, the training aspect, and Pat, I think you're, I don't know if you mentioned here with your, those who are tuned in and involved with your podcast, but you being a part of the Indiana Law Enforcement Academy training board and having that trust and confidence when we went through the pandemic, you were one of those that gave the approval for Jeffersonville Police Department to be able to hold one of the 5 satellite academies. And we were able to engage and do that in the year of 2021. And in the year now of 2022, out of the 5, Jeffersonville made the request last fall. A nice thank you letter, and I appreciate your support. You were one of those that gave the hand. We held our second law enforcement academy here in Jeffersonville. This time we had officers that were brought in that academy, and we had those officers graduate this past May and complete the 16-week certification of the Indiana Law Enforcement Academy here at Jeffersonville. Just this past week prior, I've had 6 of the 7 complete their field training, and they are out into the field, and they've completed the training course, and I have the next officer will be completing here in the next 21 days as well. So out of the 7, we're on our way. But being able to be a part of state certification, being a part of the training nexus of what the state of Indiana is doing, and a department our size of 92, something that's never been here in the southern Indiana part of the state, the Southwest Academy down in Evansville, Chief Bowen and Assistant Chief Smith, they do a fine job. I have 2 officers that are there now, part of that academy, and I had an officer in June that completed the Indiana IU Bloomington Academy, coming out of a program in college and being hired here. But being able to be part of the state and being entrusted with trust and confidence by yourself and the training board to be able to do that, our department, we thank you. But that's to the degree that we take training that serious into the focus of, you know, being a part of the certification and pushing that envelope to be able, when you're looking at certification and being able to reach that is a huge accomplishment. And that's what we work towards. But we started with our training program, and I came in what we did with the staff and what do we want to really get out the toolbox and readjust. And it's something I looked at coming from the patrol mindset, patrol supervisor, wanted to really look at training and what are we putting out with recruits then out into the field. And I think that we've been able to make that change of the organization, the culture, be able to display that vision, that mindset, and looking for new pieces of stronger and better improved communication. That's all completed through and accomplished through training.
Well, I appreciate what you're doing down in Jeffersonville. You've got a great police department. You're really looking towards the future. It's going to be exciting to see what, you know, what comes forward. And, you know, the one of the guests on the podcast is Tim Horty, the executive director from the Indiana Law Enforcement Academy. And I would encourage you to listen to that episode because, you know, the pandemic, you know, really just kind of highlighted some of the concerns I think that we all have about training and the pressure that it put on the police academies and training new officers around the country or around the state. But comparing and looking at how we're training officers around the country, a lot of interesting conversations. And in this podcast, that's one of the topics that we look to dive into, or, you know, what does the future look like, you know, in this world of reimagining and rethinking about what we can do? You know, how do we invest our time and our resources effectively to put the best product out there? And you know, when you're on, you know, in your own department, and you kind of, you know, you're we can oftentimes really be engrossed with what our own issues are. And that's understandable because police agencies are busy. That opportunity to serve on the law enforcement training board really opened my eyes to a whole new level of concerns that I have nationwide about how can we provide the best service to our young police officers. And, you know, Indiana, I feel very fortunate that we have such a significant investment that's coming into our academy. We're able to build additional resources and add to the staff and do some of the things that Director Horty is looking to accomplish to put a better product out there on the street. And, you know, we look nationwide for best practices when we do those things. And I think, you know, the walk away here is that we, you know, we're pretty good in policing, but we can always be better. And that's, I think that's our goal, is to be a little bit better tomorrow than we were today. And
absolutely.
Thank you.
Hey, I appreciate that opportunity. That's one that I didn't call out, but you're right. Director Horty, the Indiana State Police Superintendent, Doug Carter, that also with the Law Enforcement Training Board, yourself and others, I wanted to really mention that what we're doing in Indiana law enforcement and the training and the investment that's being made, that we're seeing by the commitment of the state. You know, I think that Indiana is declaring our focus and our commitment, our intent for citizens, for Hoosiers here in the state of Indiana, but what we want to do to protect our nation.
Right on. Right on. All right. Well, I'm going to keep my word. So I'm not going to ask you what book you've read. Oh, no, I have to now that I brought it up. All right. Give me one book. I want people to know, hey, what is Chief Kavanaugh reading, or what's something that he's read some point in his career that had a big impact on him, that maybe changed the way he thought about not just policing, but maybe life, and, you know, impacted the way he does his job.
You know, I had the ability to attend the Southern Police Institute at the University of Louisville. And I tell you that there were some things there you're beginning on you asked about. One, we studied the leadership challenge there and looking at the leadership challenge. And there, that was a good evolve of evolving nature of how I'm thinking and, you know, leading people. You know, how am I looking at the direction of pathway of leading people? And there's something that they do there. Beginning, you asked me about my focus of, you know, how did I get into law enforcement, public safety? They do something that's called What Makes Me Me. And it's a pretty good job there that they come out with they present to you that, you know, how do you come about yourself in a good life reflection that you hear. You share that with your class, and that's kind of credentialing that class. You come together off of that, and they build upon that and study that leadership challenge. And you asked me that question early on, what makes me me? It was about my father and coming into this profession and tying in and looking at the leadership challenge and putting it all together in context and, you know, leaving from there and being 2015 to 2018, coming into that program and then going forward, myself and administrative staff, we've all been through SBI at the time, Major McGee, Northwestern, with the five administrators here. We've completed that, but just looking and studying that and then looking at what our focus is, how we deliver, you know, I have to include that. And also to keep it right here, the 13 Days of Ferguson, that was also another good read. And for me to consider that, August the 14th, 2014, but the 13 days of that. And that was highlighted by Captain Ron Johnson there, the Missouri State Police. And, you know, for me, it was in a personal, and there's some things, some challenges that you face with these situations as a African-American police officer, but as a police administrator who is African-American. And then there is, you know, the reality of the situation. And let's face it, there is what the perception is of what people know and believe. So just reading some of the challenges of what Captain Johnson actually faced, and that was my share with our literacy program here last year in Jeffersonville, the Jeffersonville Township Public Library. I had to pick a book that shared with that. And that was one, I think, at the time I brought out, the 13 Days of Ferguson. I've got some feedback from people in the community that actually read that one. I had to pick between that leadership challenge, but I had some passion in there too, on top of with the leadership challenge and your beginning question, what makes me me. So those are two really good reads. And you look at that leadership challenge, there's, you know, that has been built on there with those individuals. It's really something that's really fine. But looking at ourselves of leading leadership and leading people and leading the organization and looking at those what makes you, me, us, ourselves, but also that me is small. It's all about we, and then we serving the people, being public servants.
No better way to end that. I have not read The 13 Days of Ferguson. That's now going on my reading list. Awesome. Thank you for your time. I appreciate you sharing your experiences with us. A lot of great information, a lot of stuff to ponder upon as I head into future episodes. But I'm looking forward to getting down to Jeffersonville again and seeing you in the near future. In the meantime, I appreciate all that you're doing, that all your team is doing. Have a great day and stay safe.
Hey, will do. Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to be here to share with you, and enjoy that retirement. Don't work too much.
Yeah, mission not accomplished.
Take care, Chief. Good to see you.
The Coptimizer podcast is powered by Performance Protocol. Performance Protocol brings professional executive coaching to police officers and administrators at all levels of the organization. Performance Protocol has the blueprint that will operationalize organizational optimization. It is purpose-built for today's public safety employees to help them accomplish goals and live better. What is it? One-on-one video-based coaching with officers and leaders who have been in your shoes and know firsthand what it means to live and work in public safety. The program will connect you with certified coaches who combine their years of success in the world of law enforcement with world-class training from the cabal of Performance Protocol coaches. Get the support, resources, motivation you need to live the life you want. Performance Protocol coaches are relatable, knowledgeable, and confidential. Most importantly, they get results. Why should the keys to unlocking our peak performance be reserved for just the boardroom or the playing field? Unleash your full potential today and get started with Performance Protocol. Remember, performance is the goal. Protocol is the path. Log into www.performance-protocol and learn more about how to bring this program to your agency and community.